Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
My name is Jeff Bradley. I'm the collection manager of mammals at the Burke Museum.
You're also, as part of your professional role, you manage a team of volunteers, a very important team here?
I manage a couple teams of volunteers, and including this one team that you're about to meet.
So they're right on the other side of this door?
Two doors, yeah.
Two doors?
Yeah.
So are these volunteers or prisoners?
Well, they could leave if they wanted, and one of my jobs is making sure they don't want to leave, and we do that by keeping them fed.
All right, let's go meet them.
Okay. Ooh, get on that.
It is ripe in here. All right.
Oh.
So I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5. And I think it's time we understand what these volunteers are and what they're doing before I, lose my lunch.
Well, this is a colony of dermestid beetles. They're sometimes called hide beetles, and they are the species of museum beetle that we have to clean our bones. When the beetles are done with the bones, the flesh is all gone, and they're just a pile of disarticulated bones that are ready for us to put into a box or vial.
So we're standing over a big sort of stainless steel, big reach-in freezer that you might keep in the back of a restaurant, and inside we have the bones of, looks like maybe a dozen different things. What's in here?
Well, this is a marten here, a forest weasel, a fairly large forest weasel, came from Mount Rainier National Park, and he came to the Burke. He's one of our newer specimens. We have a ringed seal in the corner. You can see that rib cage there.
And the larvae are the hardest workers, right, on this little team?
Yes, the adults do some work in there in terms of cleaning the flesh, but it's mostly the larvae that are doing most of the cleaning.
Are they any danger to you or humans?
Well, not necessarily a danger to us. However, they are museum pests. They're known as museum pests. They will eat anything that used to be alive. So obviously, if they were to escape into this mammal collection where we're standing right now, they might eat some of the mammal skins we have in these cases. Also, if they were to escape into other parts of the building. So it's really important to keep them here inside the colony. That's why we have the heated door jamb and the sticky traps and all the tanglefoot to make sure we don't have any escapees. But the main way we prevent escapees is by keeping them fed.
And where are these specimens coming from? I mean, you seem like you have a constant supply of dead things.
A lot of those are local animals. Maybe they've been salvaged by members of the public or by researchers.
When you say salvaged, are we talking like roadkill and stuff?
By salvage, I mean an animal that's dead before the Burke gets involved.
Why do you want them?
Every time we put a specimen into a case, that is a snapshot in time. So that is a member of that species from that location, from that date. And scientists who want to go back and study what were the mammals like here in 2017 can go back to a museum and pull out drawers full of specimens that were actually from that time period.
And you need beetles to reduce the volume.
We need beetles to help keep things into small boxes, help things fit into small boxes, yeah.
Is it possible to close mic them real quick? How would you describe that sound?
You know, I would describe that as a light rain, maybe hitting a metal roof or some sort of thin roof and just a light sprinkling. And it's constant and it's all around you.
To me, they sound like Rice Krispies. Well, we're going to hear stories of bugs from all over the place today. Our theme today is bug in the system, everything from a cybersecurity glitch to a sperm bank for bees. That's coming up right here on the show, so don't go away. Seattle attorney Bill Marler is himself a bug in the system, a fly in the ointment, a pain in the butt. Well, at least that's the point of view of a big chunk of the food industry, especially beef, poultry, and even leafy greens. He is the guy who you call if you're unfortunate enough to fall victim to another bug, like E. coli 0157H7, or Salmonella, Listeria, any of the bacteria that somehow works its way into our food production and gets into our guts. That E. coli strain became infamous when three people died and hundreds got sick after eating Jack in the Box hamburgers back in 1993.
Words cannot express my sorrow or the sadness of our employees. Our hearts ache for the families and the friends of the young boy and boys who died. Jack in the Box has moved quickly to meet this challenge. And once we determined which meat was contaminated, it was isolated, and it will be destroyed.
That was Robert Nugent, Jack in the Box's CEO in 1993, testifying before a U.S. Senate committee. One of the epicenters of that outbreak was here in Washington State. The E. coli victim who launched Bill Marler's career was a 9-year-old from Redmond named Breanne Kiner. She was one of the survivors. Marler got her a $15 million settlement from Jack in the Box.
Breanne Kiner was sort of the odd poster child of the outbreak. She was hospitalized for 6 months, and I remember seeing her on TV. This is before the family had retained me, and it was like day 36 in the coma, you know, sort of like the hostage crisis in Iran. It was a significant outbreak. There were 4 deaths, children, about 75 kids that suffered acute kidney failure. We were running out of dialysis machines here. They were shipping them in from Minneapolis. From the medical side, it was a war zone. The outbreak was figured out here in the state of Washington, in part because it was somewhat epicentered here, but also because Washington had E. coli 0157 as a reportable disease. Little known was that the Jack in the Box E. coli outbreak actually started in California 2 months earlier, but because California at the time did not require E. coli to be a reportable disease, they were flying blind.
And by that you mean that the doctors, reportable disease, a doctor is supposed to report to public health authorities.
Exactly. Yeah. And they didn't do that because they weren't required to, like they were here. And so the 50 people who got sick in Southern California were never connected. So therefore, the meat got shipped to the state of Washington. Had California had that requirement, you and I wouldn't be talking today.
Was there a particular moment or client or something that marked a bit of a turning point for you or that illustrates a period where you were transitioning from thinking this more as a job to thinking of this more as a mission?
It's complex when you're a lawyer who makes money off of people's suffering. And so the more someone's suffering, the more valuable their case is. And the more someone suffers, the more you can feel it inside of yourself. And I think as a parent, I think as I saw kids that were like the same age as my kids, I think it was not something that was that client that did it. It was just more of a gradual changing of how I viewed it. Yeah, I'm working on a case now where it's this, you know, just beautiful young 20-year-old gal who had just gotten a job to be Cinderella at Disneyland. And she ate a food product, became sick with E. coli 0157, lost her large intestine, suffered numerous strokes, has required a kidney transplant, and you know, I'm now helping her try to find a help dog because she has seizures like frequently, and at the same time she's trying to go to college. It doesn't take much to sort of feel pretty like I want to go to work and work on that kid's case because it's the right thing to do and it's going to help her, but it's also going to hopefully change an industry's behavior.
So where do you see yourself and litigation more broadly existing in the bigger ecosystem of like regulation, enforcement, public health? Where do you fit in?
I think if you had asked me that question 25 years ago, I would have said, all the lawsuits I bring create change and make people do the right thing and prevent these things from happening. But that's not what happens. Suing people doesn't change behavior. You have to approach it in a much more, shall I say, holistic way. And that, to me, was being much more public about the victims and telling their stories, and to do a lot more public outreach to businesses and consumer groups and politicians, and to work on legislation and regulation. I actually think the regulatory structure that we now have in the United States is actually functioning. From 1993 to about 2003, about 95% of my law firm's revenue was E. coli cases linked to hamburger. And today, that's zero. Doesn't mean that you can't get sick from eating an undercooked hamburger. You can, and people do. But the mass outbreaks, the mass recalls don't exist anymore. We're starting to see the same thing now happening in leafy greens.
Why is that? I feel like a lot of people don't quite understand. I mean, you can understand why an undercooked hamburger would get you sick, but why would spinach get you sick?
So E. coli 0157 was a product of feedlots. It's now a bug that's environmental. You'll find them in deer, you'll find them in pigs, you'll find it in lakes. A little freaky sort of fact is about 50 E. coli bacterium is enough to make you sick or kill you. 100,000 of them would fit on the head of a pin.
Because even if a small number of those spinach plants or something are contaminated or have pig poop on them or whatever.
When you mix it together, and a great example is the large spinach outbreak in 2006, their version of Jack in the Box. We linked it to a 20-acre organic spinach farm. Not all of the 20 acres of spinach were evenly coated with E. coli. It was in little pockets. And so, but when you harvested it all at the same time and you washed it all at the same time and you bagged it all at the same time, 205 people got sick, 5 people died. Had you just harvested that spinach like the way we used to do spinach, like in bunches and buy it in a grocery store, probably would not have seen any illnesses.
How do you approach people who have a kind of fatalistic attitude about this? Like, oh, you know, if it's not one thing, it's another. Something's going to get you. We hear every day that, you know, the bacteria in your sponge are going to kill you, you know, different things like that. So how do you approach that attitude?
It's harder for me not to be paranoid because I'm subjected to things on a, you know, daily basis. And certainly, you know, I remember 20 years ago, I was representing a number of kids who got E. coli from a swimming pool, and it was in Atlanta, and I actually wound up being in the ICU with the family when they pulled the plug on their kid. I'd never seen anyone die before, and I was a young dad, and I remember getting on the plane, flying home, coming back to Bainbridge Island, getting home like 6 or 7 in the afternoon, and tacked to the front door was, "Bill, I'm with the kids. We're up at the pool."
From your wife?
Yeah. And I was just, and I drove up to the pool and I got out of the car and I was like, "Get the kids out of the pool. Get them out of the pool." And there were all these, you know, friends of my wife's, and it was our little golf and country club pool. And I've never lived that down. But it was, you know, it was the moment.
Bill Marler is one of the country's best-known food safety attorneys. He's based here in Seattle. Thank you so much for talking with us, Bill.
Oh, thanks. It was enjoyable.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is Bug in the System. This next story is about a computer bug with tragic consequences. The story starts June 10, 1999 in Bellingham. A pipeline that runs between Seattle and an oil refinery in Ferndale springs a leak. Locals start to smell gasoline, and it soon becomes clear that gas is leaking into Whatcom Creek. Firefighter Ryan Provencher goes to investigate.
We've got explosive levels, could probably take out 2-3 city blocks.
Captain Jaquish got out to investigate. His eyes got huge as he looked over the bridge. And right then I knew that this was a little bigger than what we thought it was going to be. And at that time, I just took a moment to walk over and take a look for myself, and just couldn't believe what I was seeing. I mean, it was literally just free-flowing gasoline, and the vapors went as high as you could see. It just blurred the whole landscape behind the creek.
Okay, my dog's in seizure now.
Your dog is having seizures?
The fumes are everywhere. My dog can't walk anywhere. We're getting the hell out of here. Something's bad.
All right.
The creek is full of oil. It's something toxic.
All right, we've got people on the way.
Yeah, well, they better get here soon. You got
okay.
a problem.
All right.
We went in to Whatcom Falls Park and started walking towards the water treatment plant, just trying to get an idea of where this was coming from. We were just crossing the little footbridge towards the water treatment plant when the explosion occurred.
911, there's a big smoke. The sky is smoke.
911.
Yes, I'd like to report an explosion.
Okay.
This is Alabama here. 911.
Yeah, I'm on Iowa Street and I just saw like a very big explosion.
The flames and smoke came down the valley. And all I remember is it completely filled the V of the valley there. The fireball was above the trees. All I remember thinking was it can't be that much. It's just gonna, burn for a few minutes and then it's gonna die down and the problem will start going away. And I remember it was like 15 or 20 minutes. It's still just roaring. And I'm just going, my God, what have we got?
That last voice was Ron Morehouse, the battalion chief for the Bellingham Fire Department at the time. And what they had on their hands turned out to be far worse than they'd imagined. Almost 300,000 gallons of highly volatile gas leaked from the Olympic pipeline into creeks that went right through downtown Bellingham. When the fuel exploded, over a mile of the creek caught fire. A massive plume of dark smoke rose 30,000 feet into the air. Two 10-year-old boys playing near the water and an 18-year-old fisherman died. The final report on the Olympic pipeline explosion put most of the blame on a backhoe puncturing the pipeline. But Joe Weiss says it's not that simple. He's an expert in cybersecurity for industrial systems, things like pipelines, refineries, and power plants. He's studied the Bellingham incident, and he says what happened there nearly 20 years ago is still very much relevant today.
I remember seeing this event on the national news, because it's not often a creek catches fire and kills people. You know, you think of the Cuyahoga River, you don't think about a creek in Washington State. But then what really got me, I was pushed to start a control system cybersecurity conference. And one of the people that attended was from the National Transportation Safety Board.
And that's the agency that was doing the investigation?
Yes.
The official investigation?
Yes. So when NTSB showed up at the conference and said they were finalizing the report of the Bellingham, Washington gasoline pipeline rupture, it's like, wait a minute. You're saying then it really wasn't that backhoe that nicked the line that caused the problem?
It sounds like there were multiple causes that were identified by that official report. What role do you think that you mentioned the SCADA, that's the computer system that was supposed to be monitoring and enable
yes.
the humans to exert control over what was going on in the pipelines?
So every 3 to 7 seconds, it would update itself and you would be able to see what was going on.
Including things like what the pressure was inside the pipeline at
yes.
different points.
Yes. But minutes before the accident, the SCADA system went from a 3 to 7 second scan rate to every 30 seconds, to every 400 seconds, to being totally unresponsive. So right before the accident, the SCADA stopped working.
Would this explosion have happened if the SCADA system were functioning as it was supposed to?
I don't believe so. If the SCADA system and the sensors were working properly, you would have seen the pressure build up in the lines. And you could have taken action to have tried to reduce the pressure in those lines.
How much do we rely on these computerized, in some cases automated, industrial control systems? How widespread are these things, and what kinds of things do they support?
Try everything. Without them, we're back in the 1850s. This is transportation, energy, power, manufacturing. Defense. Our entire infrastructure is built on this automation.
Why does this Bellingham incident specifically mean so much to you personally? Like, why do you care so much about this one episode?
Because there are so many aspects of Bellingham that are still relevant today and that are still not being addressed today.
Was there a kind of culture or mentality at this time around industrial control systems that comes into play? I mean, like, what's the context that this happened in?
Well, it's the same context today. There is still a major approach to rely on your sensors and to rely on automation.
So how worried should we be about, say, nuclear launch officers at missile sites still using floppy disks and all this outdated technology?
Here's the funny part. From a cyber perspective, that's probably the best thing you can do.
Really? Why? That's counterintuitive. I mean, why?
Here's the trade-off for the catch-22. Going to modern digital is going to give you a more reliable, more productive system. The flip side is it will give you a much more cyber vulnerable system. Productivity versus security. They're not necessarily compatible.
So, Joe, this gets to something that this whole conversation makes me wonder about. I just wonder what incidents like this Bellingham explosion and all the things that have followed in its wake, what do they say about the limits of sort of human versus technology, what we should leave in the hands of people and what we should leave in the hands of technology?
Part of what's happening is the law of unintended consequence. What we're doing as we're moving to this fully digital, fully interconnected world is we're having interconnections we hadn't necessarily anticipated. And the more complex we become, the more that's going to be there.
But you're not a Luddite. I mean, you're not anti-technology. You're not saying
no.
We should...
No. And there is no stopping the technology. But we need to step back and really ask, where shouldn't we be using this?
Joe Weiss is a cybersecurity expert and managing partner at Applied Control Solutions in San Jose, California. It's Sound Effect from 88.5. Gabriel Spitzer here, and this week our theme is Bug in the System.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, hurry, 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 step right up and gather round. Witness what has been regaled to be the marvel of the modern age. You've heard about it on the radio. You've read about it in the magazines. Now see it for yourself up close and personal. The one, the only, the 187th wonder of the world, Professor Payne's phantasmagorical circus of performing fleas. Yes, siree, Bob, you heard me right. For here, on this table, is a genuine, authentic, 100% bona fide flea circus featuring a cadre of performing fleas gathered at great personal expense.
Payne Fifield is a part-time professional magician in Seattle and owner of what I think is the city's only flea circus. Now, if you're like me, you may not have realized that flea circuses were an actual thing, rather than just a gag in the Looney Tunes cartoons.
But I cannot have the flea circus with only one little flea.
Don't worry, Pepito. I'll get you some more fleas, somehow.
But man, did I learn a thing or two about flea circuses from Professor Payne. In the living room of his Wallingford house, he explained that flea circuses have a long and proud history stretching back centuries.
They started back in the 15th and 16th centuries with jewelers or clockmakers demonstrating their skill at doing little tiny things by putting gold wire around the thorax of a flea, and they would wear them like necklaces. They would have these necklaces of hundreds of little fleas on the, you know, sort of alive. And it was to demonstrate the fineness of their work, because you have to be able to put it around the thorax in such a way that you don't strangle the flea or too loose that it can escape. So you just have to do it just right. And then in the 1820s, as far as I can determine, is when the first flea circuses started showing up, where they would take these fleas and they would attach them to little chariots or little wagons, or put them in little kind of dresses where they would sort of turn around and dance, or they would do little high dives. You kind of determined if the fleas you had were jumpers or walkers, and the walkers you'd attach to wagons, and the jumpers you'd make high dive fleas.
You find out their talents.
You find out their talent. You're just sort of sitting there with a big vat of fleas, I guess, going, okay, what are you going to do? And since they only live for a few months, weeks to months, you're always getting new cast members, I guess. Because once they're harnessed for life. You don't take the harness back off. And so they live attached to their little cart or dress for the rest of their little flea lives.
What is the humbug flea circus?
Humbug flea circus is a contrivance, a device designed to mimic the activities of actual fleas. It's a little circus usually set up inside of what looks to be an open suitcase. The traditional ones are the high dive, the trapeze, the wire walk, the cannonball, the flea parade.
Why don't you use real fleas?
My eyes aren't good enough to actually harness a flea. And the fact that the fleas that they use traditionally in flea circuses are Pulex irritans, the human flea, which are very difficult to come by these days.
Is that different from the fleas on my cat?
Yes, the fleas on your cat are very, very, very small. The human flea is much larger. You can actually see one with the naked eye. It's all imaginary and just driven with the force of your personality. An actual flea circus, you had to be pretty close to see what they were doing, but you could actually take it into a theater in vaudeville, and you didn't have to worry about the weather. You know, if you had a real flea circus, you arrive at the theater and all your fleas were dead because it got too cold or too hot. And the other drawback of having a real flea circus is you have to feed them every night. And so there's pictures of people, flea circuses, with their entire cast on their arms in their little wagons and things, feeding, because yes, where they get the blood is from the guy that owns the circus.
The ringmaster.
The ringmaster, yeah, has to feed his cast.
So getting into a very old and probably, fair to say, dying art, how did you go about teaching yourself how to do it?
There's a guy named Walt Noon who was approached by a guy from Seattle by the name of Rob DeArc, who wanted to build a flea circus. And this must have been 20, 30 years ago. There was very little literature written on how you make these things. So they kind of backward engineered it from archival footage and interviewing people and stuff. And they came up with a VHS tape, originally a VHS tape, to how to make these things.
Do you need any exotic materials?
Not really. You can make them completely manual, but some of the trapeze works better with engines than it does trying to move your hand back and forth. And a lot of the modern ones are all radio controlled, and that's a little bit beyond my technical capabilities.
Well, I'm looking at yours right now. So we're sitting in your living room, and it's there over on a table all set up and bedecked. Can you give me a little bit of a tour of it?
Oh, sure. Here we can. Here is the high dive, towering nearly 9 inches above the circus floor. And in the back, there's the high wire where Dimitri and Annette will walk across the high wire. Miss Nimbus, Queen of the Air, is our funambulist, and she does the trapeze here. Altoid, the curiously strong flea, he'll actually untie these handkerchiefs and lift a 50-cent piece up on a playing card. And Drake is the flea that does the high dive for me. And I have Marcel. I have the only mime flea in the entire known world.
A mime flea?
Mime flea, yes. He's on an exchange program from France. I gave strict instructions that the air conditioning not be turned on during... Oh, I'm sorry. It's my fault. It's Marcel's incredible mime ability. He's actually walking against the wind. Ooh, the realism is stunning. And oh, look at that. He's picked up some sort of object. It looks like a rope, and he's pulling on it. It must be...
What do you like about them? Something very, very heavy.
that no one else has one. That it sets me apart. It's neat because you get people that they've always heard about it, but they've never seen one. So you get that kind of interesting, you know, response from people going, "Wow, I've never seen one of these before," you know, and now I never have to see one again. But
Miss Nimbus, jump from one trapeze to the other. Give her a big round of applause, and now she will jump back, doing a double. There's one. There's two, and she lands! A big round of applause! And oh, she's going to do a triple. Let's try it. One, two, three. Oh, there she goes! And now for the big finale.
Professor Payne is a Seattle-based magician. He and his flea circus are available for parties. You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking about bugs in the system. Brandon Hopkins was on track to become a high school biology teacher, and then he was invited by one of his professors at Washington State University to work in a lab with honeybees.
Yeah, I bought every kind of itch cream they sold in the store because my hands were swollen and itching from all the bee stings, and I soaked my hands in ice every night and, you know, questioned my decision-making.
Those decisions led him along a very unexpected career path as the guy who runs the world's only bee sperm bank. Now, people bank sperm for lots of the animals that we raise for food, cattle, pigs, sheep, but there was never a repository for the germplasm, that's what they call it, for bees. Well, at least not until Brandon Hopkins figured out how to freeze bee sperm for the first time. Today, he's an assistant research professor at WSU, and he travels the world to places like Italy, Algeria, or France to gather bee sperm and add it to the frozen collection in Pullman. When we chatted, I had to get the obvious question right out of the way. So, Brandon, let's get down to brass tacks. How do you extract semen from a bee?
We kind of squeeze the head and thorax of the bee and kind of pull back on the abdomen a little bit. And then that causes the endophallus, for the scientific listeners out there, or the penis to pop out. Then at the tip of that is a small ball of mucus, and then floating on that is a microliter or so of semen.
So what does the bee make of that?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a life-ending event for that individual male. But if we want to get anthropomorphic about it, I think it's maybe one of the better ways for a male to go in nature. So if he is successful and lucky enough to mate with a queen out there in the world, that's a life-ending event for him as well. That's the only purpose for male honeybees in the colony. They don't collect nectar or pollen, don't make honey, don't clean up around the hive. They just fly out every day looking for a potential mate. When there's no more flowers and the food starts to dry up, the workers, the females in the colonies, will actively drag out the drones, and they'll prevent them from coming back in the hive, and they'll freeze and or starve to death each fall. And then they'll just make new ones the following spring.
Wow, brutal.
Yeah, it's brutal.
So they're like they're really like tools.
Yeah, some people call it, you know, flying genitalia.
So what do you do with all that frozen bee semen?
We maintain samples of all of these collections that we've done for the conservation of that germplasm. So a real seed bank or germplasm bank. Having that genetic diversity, as we put it in the population, will help with adaptability of the population. And then also for long-term sake, you know, in case there's some other devastating issue with the bee population, will have this germplasm preserved.
So that means they'll be more resilient if there's a new disease or pest or climate change or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. And then the other benefit to going and collecting these different subspecies is that these different subspecies have very different characteristics. So one of the most popular ones used here in the U.S. is Apis mellifera ligustica, the Italian honeybee. And so it's very well adapted for that Mediterranean climate compared to a bee from the mountains, like the Caucasian honeybee from the Alps. We collect in Slovenia, or the Caucasian honeybee that from the Caucasus Mountains that we've gone to collect in the Republic of Georgia. Those mountain bees, you know, are well adapted to cold climates. They are well adapted at overwintering, you know, being very conservative with their food stores and things like that. And so by going and collecting these different subspecies, it allows U.S. beekeepers to really select for bees that are best for their region within the U.S.
And this may seem obvious, but we're not just talking about honey production here, right? Why are bees so important?
Yeah, there you go. So bees are far more valuable as pollinators than they are for honey producers.
So from the point of view of a regular person going to the supermarket and checking off items on my shopping list, what would my life be like if honeybees were to disappear or take a serious hit?
What you're left with are grains, you know, so you're left with kind of wheat and rice and things like that. So the oranges and the apples and all the small fruits, so all the kind of things that you consider sort of healthy, delicious fruits and vegetables are then gone. And then
that means that everybody really has an interest in healthy bees.
Right. Yeah. You can even contribute the pollination to our milk supply and dairy industry because they pollinate alfalfa seed that then goes to grow the hay that feeds our dairy cattle. And so that's kind of the stark outlook. But really what we're talking about is more like the drastic increase in prices of these kinds of things as these bee declines.
Even if they didn't go away entirely, they would be a lot harder to get.
Right. And I think what it would create is a major change in our agricultural system, and it wouldn't be as efficient as it is today. So you can go and look at pictures of hand pollination of apples in Japan. And so, I mean, you're talking about the labor costs of going in with a tiny little paintbrush and brushing pollen on individual flowers to produce fruits. And so you can probably imagine the cost of that apple if you have to pay someone to go hand pollinate all the flowers in the trees.
So why is this important now?
The need for managed colonies is more important than ever because it used to be that there'd be, you know, woods or natural areas around the small farms, the systems that the way they used to do it, that you wouldn't have to pay for pollination. There'd be a feral hive in the woods next door and things like that. You know, our modern agricultural system demands that we have this migratory beekeeping system.
And by that, you mean people trucking bees in.
Yeah, and I mean on a, you know, a massive scale. So we're talking about the movement of, you know, pretty close to 2 million colonies into California for almond production alone, and then 500,000 after that are moved up here to Washington for apple pollination and small fruits and all that kind of stuff. And that, you know, and that's just California and Washington.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Brandon.
Hey, thanks. And you can maybe ask your listeners to plant some bee-friendly forage out there for them in their garden,
like,
and around their house. Some things that are good for people, like if you can plant oregano or lavender or sage, those kinds of things are great for bees. Sunflowers, really a lot of those colorful purples and yellows.
That makes bees happy.
That makes bees happy, and it's one of the big contributors to the difficulties bees are having is the lack of food and forage.
Well, we'll all do our part.
All right.
Well, Brandon Hopkins is an assistant research professor at WSU, and that's where he heads up the world's only sperm bank for bees.
Thank you, sir.
All right, Brandon, take care. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect from 88.5, talking this week about bugs in the system. Many of us have dreamed of being in showbiz, getting to drop names about celebrities we've worked with. Well, Graham Owen is living that dream, just not how you may expect.
I've had Brad Pitt hold my flies and Angelina Jolie hold my spider.
So Owen is a professional prop insect maker. His Gig Harbor company, Film Flies, is responsible for making some of the bugs I guarantee you've seen, whether it's in movies or print ads or commercials on TV. Those arachnids in The Amazing Spider-Man, that was Graham's work. And when asked who else in the world creates insects as lifelike as he does, Graham says pretty confidently, no one.
What insects do I feel most proud of? I'm thinking the flies for Breaking Bad. And it was season 3, episode 10. It was actually called Fly when there were house flies in the meth lab.
There's been a contamination.
Wait, what? What happened to your head?
Nothing, I'm fine.
You didn't hit it? Like, really, really hard?
My head is not the problem, Jesse. The fly is the problem.
Do you have one of those flies that we could take a look at?
I actually have, and I'll pull them out of this drawer here. I have a whole number of them back here. And actually, some of these, I think half of them were made with a little fishing hook coming out of the body. And so they could attach it and secure it onto something. Others didn't have that little hook, and they could make it take off of a countertop by a can of compressed air off camera.
Oh, they just give it a little...
And it takes off. The eyes are glass. There's silver behind the glass to catch the light. And on these houseflies, to give them that faceted look, there's actually superfine Italian organza fabric that's pulled over that tiny little piece of glass and then tied off with very fine fly-tying thread.
So back when you were a civilian, what happened that sort of led you to change your trajectory?
I have always, since childhood, liked doing very, very fine work, detailed work. Always liked being outdoors, always liked nature. And I've always been a fisherman. And about 25 years ago, I was introduced to fly fishing. And I thought that I could save money by tying my own flies. And I think a number of fly tiers think that initially, but once you build the passion, start collecting materials, you have drawers full of things that cost a lot of money. But I would spend hours at night trying to figure out, how can I make these insects look more realistic? How can I make realistic wings, eyes, legs, the coloration?
Was this in order to catch more fish, or was it something else that was motivating you?
No. My friends used to tease me that, Graham, why would you spend 6 hours last night making a dragonfly? And I would admit that they're not to fish with. I found a creative outlet and I enjoyed doing this. And it was actually how I was first discovered. Somebody from Paramount Studios went to the Fisherman Spot, a fly fishing shop in Van Nuys, California. And I think expecting a fly shop sold flies that look like a fly. And so they asked the owner, do you know anybody that can make flies that look real? And alerted me to the fact that these companies renting dead insects were going out of business.
Why were those companies going out of business?
Because the Hollywood movie studios could no longer film dead insects. And in the credits at the end have the statement, no animals were harmed in this production. In the old days, you could have scenes with bugs, have a room full of dozens, hundreds, possibly thousands of insects. They would film what they needed to do, put the bug bombs in the room, close the doors, and basically exterminate them all and sweep them all out. Well, those days are over.
So you discovered that there's this opening created by bureaucracy in some ways, or at least a policy change, that provides a business opportunity. Was that an easy choice?
No, it was more of a risk I took. I think when the value of what I do struck me, they were filming Bedtime Stories with Adam Sandler, and they needed a bee to sting Adam Sandler on the lip. If I wasn't there, they had a big plastic bee that was pink and ugly and didn't look realistic at all, about the size of a football. They would have set up two cameras and filmed briefly that bee. At the same identical time, they're filming Adam Sandler pretending there's a bee on his lip.
Ow!
Skeeter, are you all right?
A bee stung my tongue!
Just a few seconds of a bee on his lip would have cost about $65,000. And
how much did you sell them or rent your bees to them for?
$350 each a week.
Can you show me around your desk a little bit?
Sure.
So you have a couple of shelves here full of these pigments, many, many dozens of different types.
Well, what I have here on these shelves, I don't buy any store-bought paints. I buy the finest pigments. Most of these are all from Professor Kramer in Germany, from Kramer Pigments.
These, they're powders?
And yes, they're all powders. So, you know, if I want a gold ochre, you know, it's from the ground in Italy. Burnt umber is from Cyprus. I have colors from volcanic colors from Iceland. So you can see I have quite a collection here, and all my iridescent colors down there. And so some of these little jars of pigments I spent thousands of dollars on.
So you must know the anatomy and the kind of biomechanics of these insects really, really well. Does that interest you?
Yes, it does to some degree. This all goes back to fly fishing. I used to collect insects, and so I could take them home and look at them, study them, and basically try and replicate them. So the first few times I had people come to my little art area, which wasn't much more than a cubicle at the back of my house in Burbank, I would set out all my entomology books, anything to do with insects. I had photographs of living insects trying to mate with my insects, so I had some...
Wait, you've had real insects try and mate with things that you have created?
You put a realistic fake insect out there, basically as bait, it's not uncommon to have a mayfly come and land on it and check it out. Almost looks like they're kissing and doing other things.
That must be the ultimate seal of approval.
I think so.
Do you feel like connected to them?
I feel connected to nature in general. If you zoom in close enough on an ugly little spider or an earthworm, you get in close enough that you don't realize what this animal is, but you can see the detail, the color, the something God created that's absolutely beautiful and has a life and needs to be respected.
Can you give me an example of something that you found beauty in by looking at it very closely?
I guess the one I struggled with the most was cockroaches. Cockroaches and crickets, but if you do get in there close enough, that actually just the shells on them, if you look close enough, you zoom in and just look at the eyes of something and see that it's alive. You know, I don't think there's anything that's truly ugly. I think that's part of why I'm successful is I try and capture and share and allow others to see the things I see.
If you're interested in seeing some of Graham Owen's insect props, we'll have pictures and links at knkx.org. Time to bug out for this week, guys. And just before we depart, I just want to say, yes, we know that bugs are a very specific type of organism with six legs and sucking mouth parts, and we have used that definition a little more broadly than a scientist might, so, you know, hang on to your emails. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing, with help from Shane Mailing. Thanks also this week to Allie Ferguson. Parker Miles Blom helps with our photos and video, and Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and we would be so, so grateful if you'd take a minute while you're there to rate and review the show. You can also find us on Facebook by searching KNKX Sound Effect. Come on back next week when our theme is Better Late Than Never. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.